Really?
Working with Flyer? When you just zone out, you put your music on and you just chat?
Excuse me, is this your taxi?
You can't mistake their anthology, a Girls Aloud commentary podcast from The Record Doctor.
Whenever you're ready.
Hello, my fellow Alouders, and welcome to yet another installment of the Girls Aloud podcast with your host, Adam Eve. That's me. Hello, hello. I'm going to do things very differently for this episode because it's a very, very special episode, and I have a very, very special guest joining me for this episode. Having known the girls for quite a long time, even being trusted to help two of them write their autobiographies, it is an absolute pleasure to welcome onto the Girls Aloud podcast the wonderful Terry Ronald. Hello, Terry.
Hello. How are you going? I'm good. How are you?
I'm really, really good, thanks. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely my pleasure. I wanted to have you on for a while, so let's, I guess, take it back to the very start and talk about the very start, or more specifically, when you first met the girls.
I first met them, it was a studio in West London, and it was very, very early days. I think it's before they'd even done their first album. And I was just down there to just do some, you know, I can't even remember the song, I can't remember. I can barely remember why I was there. It was either like doing warm-ups with them or a bit of vocal coaching. I was just basically sent down to the studio to sort of get them into doing this vocal. And that's the first time I met them. And I just remember them. They were all so young and so kind of green. I mean, not the sort of sophisticated women that they became. I remember that, you know, their driver going out and getting their breakfast and, you know, they're all sitting there and they just look so young. They look like little, you know, little girl babies. And that's all I really remember about the first time I met them. The second time I met them was when I did two tracks for them. I didn't really do a lot of production and stuff for Girls Aloud. Mine was more on a live, working with them live and on TV. But I did do two things with them. One of them was they did a gig at GAY, and we did a cover of Hanging on the Telephone with them. I don't know whether that's when they came out of telephone boxes or something, or, you know. So I did that with them, and I produced that with Ian Masterson. And then, of course, we did Girls on Film, which was like a B-side or something, and then ended up on the deluxe version of the, you know, first album. So yeah, I did Girls on Film with them. So that time when I met them doing those vocals, I remember Girls on Film was very clearly, because we had so little time to do it, and it was just like one in, one out. But that was the second time I met them, and then it was quite a long time before I started doing vocals with them.
Right, right. So that's fascinating that you did the cover of Hanging on the Telephone with them and Ian as well. Because that was on the bonus disc of The Sound of Girls Aloud, I think.
And what goes on Film?
Hanging on the Telephone.
Oh, was it?
It was eventually released on the first greatest hits that they did on the second disc. And I love that cover. So it makes sense that, it was a...
Well, the thing is, it's, you know, but it's a Blondie song. Blondie were my kind of idols. So I suppose if Pete Lorraine was going to get anyone to do a cover of Hanging on the Telephone, it was going to be me.
Oh, that's brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. So, well then, let's talk about some of the other work that you did do with them on the vocal live front. What are some of the performances that you remember working alongside with them?
I think the big one was the Brit Awards, where the promise at the Brit Awards, because that was so exciting, because they'd finally sort of been nominated for Brit, and the performance was great. The sort of creative directorial side of it that Beth Honan did was amazing. The choreography was great. And, you know, they sounded really, really good. And I was very happy with that. I think the best thing for me was I didn't work on a lot of the tours. I did a lot of TVs, but I never did a lot of the tours. I think it's a typical thing when people do tours that, you know, the last thing that's sometimes considered is the vocals. That, you know, that it's hair, makeup, glamour, and everybody forgets.
Right.
And I remember when I first worked on the tour, worked on, I think it was the, whatever, I can't remember, the Out on Control or the one before. Anyway, when I actually did a tour with them, I remember after the show, I think it was Kim's mum and dad, I think it was Kim's dad, Kimberly's dad, like grabbing me and just saying, the vocals have never sounded so amazing as they did at that show. And I was so happy with that. I was really, really happy. So that was nice. But yeah, of course, that I worked on a couple of the tours and all the TV specials and all the TV. I was at every TV performance they did, even the ones that didn't go so well.
Oh wow, really? Well, that's amazing. We've all got our favourite TV performances, and obviously a lot of the fans cite the Brit Awards performance as a career-defining moment. So that would have been really, really exciting to be a part of. Did you know that it was going to be as big as it ended up being, that performance?
Well, it always is, you know, Brits are always a big thing. I think even then, particularly, they were even a bigger thing. I think, you know, people seem to take a lot more notice of it then. For me, it was quite hard because I had to be in the truck because although I wanted to be, you know, in the room, it was more important for me to know what was going on coming through the TV.
Right.
You know, so I had to make sure that I was in the truck to make sure.
And of course, the amazing walking primrose moment from Sarah, which is a moment in the song and the performance that everyone really, really looks back on with such fond eyes and ears.
Yeah, is that right? Oh.
I think we should also maybe talk about your connection to your manager Hillary at the time.
Yes.
Because everybody listening loves a bit of Hillary on the pod.
Well, Hillary and I have got such a history because she managed me as a songwriter producer. And then I think it was through that she got introduced to Danny, because obviously when Danny was doing, when Danny was about to do the Reva track, I think it started. And that's when they met and they ended up getting together. And with the girls, that came a bit later. I think that was because of Peter Lorraine from Polydor's connection with the girls. And, you know, I think it's fair to say, I think it's well documented and it's not bad mouthing anyone to say that Louis was not doing a good job. You know, the girls were going to get dropped if they didn't have proper management. And, you know, they've all said that in interviews in their books. So it's not out of place for me to say that. And so Peter said, you know, we need to sort the management out. And I think that that's where Hillary stepped in. And was a lot more hands-on with them. But, you know, so then imagine this, like you're managed by Hilary Shaw at the same time that she's managing Danny Minogue and Girls Aloud. Like, how much fucking time do you think I got out of that arrangement?
Not a lot at all.
Literally, like, hello, hi, who's this? No. Who are you?
Oh, my God.
What makeup do you need?
Oh my goodness.
It was just, you know, but then again, out of that, because Hills was working with the girls, I then, you know, again, when they were going for TV shows, they were just shoved on TV and not like sometimes they were doing lots of lip syncing and stuff. And, you know, all the girls wanted to sing live. They didn't want to be lip syncing on TV shows. So it's like, but you need someone there to make sure that's all happening properly. And you need someone in the control room. So then Hillary said, right, well then, so I went in. I think the first one I did was a whole lot of history. And we ended up doing an arrangement so that they're on the TV, on the live TV show, there were loads of harmonies on the live version that weren't in the record, and they were all split. They all split and did harmonies, which they were all absolutely more than capable of doing. And that's what I did for them after that. Instead of them just, you know, because a lot of the tracks, there's not massive amount of harmonies on all the tracks. So we would, for the live stuff, add stuff, augment stuff, put some extra ad libs in, put harmonies on, and yeah, that's how it worked. So when we did the tour, the same as the tour, we would work out who was singing what harmony, and we'd do lovely little a cappella bits and harmony bits that, you know, that they didn't always get a chance to do in the studio.
Right. And because that's not long after Whole Lot of History, the promotion surrounding Whole Lot of History, they came to Australia and did a whole bunch of shows here. And everywhere that they performed here, they had to perform live. Everywhere. There was none of the lip syncing, because they used to do that back in the day, but yeah, there was no lip syncing. And I remember everyone saying how incredible they sounded and how great the harmonies were, because I remember they did a harmony bit for a Whole Lot of History. So it's just interesting, yes, connecting the dots, yeah, now from my head.
What was first? Was See the Day first or Whole Lot of History?
See the Day was first.
Okay, well, that was probably the first one I worked on then.
Right.
I think it was See the Day, yeah.
Yeah, because that was released after Biology was released.
Yeah, it was around that time. But, it was fun. And Hillary, you know, was always, you know, she's kind of a bit legendary now in both the Danny and the Girls Aloud.
Yes. You
know, because she almost, like, she's... The thing about Hills is she's kind of more... she's almost more high maintenance than the actual artist she's managing. Which is hilarious. And everybody knows that about, but yeah, yes, but it basically was because of Hills that I got to work with the girls, because she was working with them. And of course she trusted me to go in and do my thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm kind of grateful to her, because I probably wouldn't have had that had it not been for Hills.
Right. Well, obviously get to your work on Kimberly and Sarah's autobiographies a little later on, but yeah, I'd love to pick your brain about, I guess, your, in general, favourite Girls Aloud moments, whether it be from the music, the videos, the tours and performances, sort of what stuff really sticks out to you now looking back on it?
Well, I can't mention some of it, so that's that. so, end of. No, what's my favourite moments? Oh, that's really hard. I think the Brits was one of my favourite things. Right. And I think that, I think also when we did the collaborations on the TV show were great. You know, when they did, what's the song they did with the Kaiser Chiefs?
I Predict a Riot.
I Predict a Riot. And, you know, that was, I really enjoyed doing those things. Wow. And getting to meet those other people, because he was lovely, Ricky. I remember he was really lovely, actually quite shy. And also when we did the TV show, and they did the James Morrison Broken Strings, and then they also went on to do that live, and that was fab. There were some really lovely bits, and I think all the girls had really nice things to do on that. There are a lot of good TV shows. The TV specials were good, because there was a lot of different stuff happening, all the different guests and artists. And also it was always nice when we did a cover version of something for live, and then I would get to do the arrangement from scratch rather than, you know, taking it from something that had already been recorded. I always enjoyed that kind of stuff. Like they did like Movie Medley one time, and, you know, I think I worked on, even though I didn't really work on that tour, I worked on that with them. And yeah, so all those things were fun. So there was that, you know, that very famous moment when Sarah did a rather off note on a morning TV show, and I was there, so I was wholly responsible, and, you know, and no one's ever let me forget it. Basically, it was like, fuck knows what time in the morning, so early. Like, I'm like, why are we? They'd been out the night before. It was right near Christmas. It was their last job before Christmas. It was like, why are we doing this live? It's like morning TV. It was literally like 6 o'clock in the morning or something horrific. And there we all are, blurry-eyed. They've been out, you know, it wasn't a good, it was, you know, they've probably been to a Christmas party the night before. So there we are. I can't even remember what song it was. Was it The Loving Kind? Or Untouchable. I think it might have been. I think it was 11. Anyway, Sarah's meant to do this long note into the thing. She wasn't really with it. She hadn't had enough coffee. And like, those shows are just not set up for musical guests. They're crap. They've got no reverb. They've got nothing. It's not like a chat show like a Graham Norton or a Paul O'Grady where you have a musical guest. It's just awful. And the song, it always sounds really dry. The studio looks dry. It's like, why don't we just mime? What am I doing here? And anyway, they did it live. And Sarah did this note that she obviously, it's like wrong and strong. You know, she started wrong and it never got better. And I just remember this note. I couldn't, there was a gaggle of people around the control desk and I just couldn't fucking get to the fader to turn it down. And it was just like, oh my God, I literally, and there was all these guys at the thing, so I couldn't get to it. And it's like, it was going out live. And I'm like, oh my God. And I just remember Cheryl's face. If you watch it back, you can see her.
The side
just
eye.
The side eye. It was just like, oh. It was, so that was a very funny story. And, you know, it's gone down in pop history, that. And, you know, I was the person responsible for their vocals on TV that day. And yeah, it wasn't good.
Maybe not, but thank you, because forever etched in our minds.
It's an iconic moment. It really is.
Right. Well, I guess the answer to this next question, it greatly varies from person to person, especially when I speak to them about it. But what is it about Girls Aloud that you think that you love most about them?
I think they were the best girl band of that whole era, from like, if you go from the 90s and 2000s right through, and I mean the best, I mean, and not a lot of people would, there's one other obvious girl band that people would probably cite as that, but for me, I just thought that the girls' records were brilliant, and like innovative and quite cool, and what Xenomania did with them was, you know, was really good. They were making quite groundbreaking pop records, I thought, in the similar way to Danny's Neon Nights. You know, when you hear something like Biology, for instance, it's the most ridiculous structure ever. Like, barely any of it repeats twice.
Right.
But it's just brilliant. Because every bit of it is so catchy. It's literally like they threw like seven songs together. It's mad, but it works. And they did that with a few songs. And I just thought that, I just think that their records as a singles collection of that time, of that era of band, not even a girl band, I would say any of the pop bands, you know, that went from when pop sort of really re-emerged from the sort of late 90s to sort of, that 10 years, early 2000s, going up to sort of 2008, 2009. I think they were they had the best singles collection. I really do.
Yeah.
And that's why I like them. And also I think they all offered something different as personalities, without it being a forced thing. They were all naturally, you know, they didn't all have to have different names, and they were just who they were, and people liked them for that, really. And that's not putting down any other bands around at the same time, because they were all amazing, you know, whether it was S Club, whether it was Spices, Steps, they all did their thing brilliantly. Mm-hmm. But for me, I just thought the girls had that edge, they had that coolness.
Right, definitely, which was kind of unheard of when looking into where they came from, which was the reality television machine.
Yeah.
They had a very different rise beyond that, and I think that it didn't take too long for them to sort of like wash that reality television stigma away from them, and everyone sort of focused on how great they were as a band.
But can I tell you why that happened? That happened because of one person. That really happened because of Peter Lorraine and the people around him, because he, you know, he was the first one with that reality TV, and you know, it didn't happen for a long time after, because even with X Factor, Simon and, you know, and whoever was doing the first one, Pete Waterman, they all tended to go down that same route of doing that, you know, slightly cheesy, big ballady, Christmassy number one-y. Mm-hmm. Peter didn't do that. He went to someone kind of, you know, he went off and went to someone that was doing kind of cutting edge pop and did that as their first record. So what happened was, the boys in that situation came up with this, you know, quite bland, kind of cheesy, poppy thing. And the fucking girl, I mean, literally, it's like, you know, it just, they didn't even stand a chance.
No.
That record was like, no one had ever done that on a reality. Well, there wasn't that many reality. But even after that, you know, they still, you know, it was still always like when someone won those shows, no matter how cool they were, they ended up doing some, you know, cover of a ballad or a, you know, cheesy Christmassy big pattern with a big key change chorus at the end. You know, they did that for years, even if it didn't suit them. Whereas Pete never did that with the girls. He just did a great pop song. And that, and I think that continued that attention to detail of making it. And I think because Peter was kind of leading the way with that, and the A&R team around him, he was very, you know, I talk to Peter all the time about music. We have such similar upbringings as far as music is concerned. He loved, you know, the bands he loved from the 80s, and, you know, he put that aesthetic into Girls Aloud.
Right.
You know, whether it was the kind of the pop bands, the electronic bands, he put that aesthetic, help put that aesthetic into them. And I think that's why they stood out from all the other reality TV acts.
And even just pop acts in general, especially around that time. I mean, who was releasing as their first single, like a, you know, drum and bass style pop track?
Yeah.
Nobody was.
No.
And you're right. They had the boys, and they just had no chance in hell up against such a huge, huge track. I mean, the track did well, reasonably well in Australia, and then after that, nothing really happened. And I think that if the girls had been around, say, because Little Mix were very, very popular in Australia and were sort of marketed from the beginning of Little Mix's story in Australia as well. And I think that if something like that had happened for the girls, then they would have had a very, very different outcome here as well, which is a shame.
Yeah. No, you're probably right.
Want to ask you about the excitement of their 20th anniversary, which is at full bloom with a lot of the fans, thanks to the vinyl release of Sound of the Underground and the remastering of their videos and digital releases. I mean, finally, we have the girls not only in 4K quality, but in high definition sound and on vinyl. So it's been quite the exciting few months for us.
Yeah.
So I was really, really excited when I got my package of the CD and the vinyl and everything like that. And it's good to see the girls making chart history again all these years later.
With
a record that's 20 years old now.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, well,
stuff.
I think it still resonates. Good pop is good pop. And it just, you know, it's... and I think the fans of the... particularly that era of music... are very loyal and they stick with it. And I think sometimes the people that had the, you know, were fans of the music in the early 2000s, it really was the last great sort of resurgence of pure pop. And I think people are a bit starved of that still. So there are a lot of people that are still, you know, so I think that's a, although there is a lot of fantastic pop music on, you know, I discover it all the time.
Yeah.
It's just not always what's played on the radio.
That's the thing.
So, you know, if you stream music, I find so much good pop music and I love it and I'm listening to it. I think, God, this is amazing. And it's, but I don't know whether it's popular or not, because I might go to that artist and they might have 2 million listeners or they might have 12,000. I don't know. And that's great for me because I don't judge someone on whether it's being force-fed me. I'm just judging whether I like it or not because it's been recommended to me. But yeah, and I think that's why, you know, these pop records, you know, like Sound of the Underground, when they've come out on vinyl, have done so well because they've got the loyalty of that fan base who are, you know, some still, you know, craving the era of that great pop music. I have a standout Girls Aloud song that is my favourite Girls Aloud song. And not only is it my favourite Girls Aloud song, it's one of my favourite pop songs.
Right.
Guess what it is?
Oh, I don't know.
It's Call the Shots.
Oh, Call the Shots, of course. That's Steve's as well.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, that's
yes.
Interesting. That's yeah. Interesting. Well, typically that we pick the same one. It's my favourite, you know. And do you know what really fucks me off? Is that's the one campaign I didn't get to work on.
Oh, shit.
Because it came out while I was on my honeymoon. And I couldn't do the TVs and the things around it. I couldn't do it. And that was my favourite song. And I didn't get to do the campaign.
So let's talk about your work on Kimberly's book, A Whole Lot of History, which I have right here.
Oh, bless.
And how did she first approach you to start working on that with her?
Well, you know, by then I had started writing. I can't remember what year I did that with her. In fact, I was looking yesterday at the years I did that. I think it was 2012 did that together, which was kind of when they weren't...
Before so, the 10 had kicked off, yeah.
Yeah, I had basically written a couple. I'd done my novel, I had done Danny's book, and I had done, I think, two other books. I think I'd done an actress called Pauline Quirk, and I'd also done Talisa.
Yes.
So I hadn't done many, but it was becoming a thing. And then Kimberly was going to do an autobiography, and... the publisher, I knew the publisher, and so obviously Hillary came to me and asked me to do it. And it seemed, you know, it seemed an obvious thing for me to do it. A, being a writer, B, knowing, you know, so much background with the girls. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny that over the years, you know, I've always got on so well with Kim. I mean, I think particularly when we did that book, that sort of cemented that. I mean, she's always... Of all the girls, I mean, I went to her wedding, there were only about, you know, 60 or so, there wasn't that many people, 70 people. And it was in Barbados. So, you know,
it
was quite an honor, you know. And the same with, you know, she'd recently had a big birthday last year and Mark and I went to that. You know, she's always been one of those people that's always kind of invited me with close friends and family.
Right.
Which has always been lovely. And even when we had Sarah's, you know, the charity thing for Sarah, the big charity ball that the girls threw, you know, Mark and I were on Kim's table, right. You know, out of all the people in that room, all the girls had a table, and, you know, we were on Kim's table, which is, it always means quite a lot to me with the way she is. So it was great for me doing the book with her, and it was very relaxed. She's a very easy voice to get because she's very natural. She's a very natural talker. And, you know, she's got that kind of northern warmth.
I could listen to her talk all day.
Yeah, I would just get the train. I would just get the train to the station near where she lived, hop in a cab from the station, and I would spend like 3 or 4 hours at her house. We'd have cups of tea. You know, we did it through the summer. So we just chatted. And, you know, I loved because she's... You know, it was doubly good for me because apart from pop, she loves musical theatre and I love musical theatre. So we'd be gassing about what musicals we loved and, you know, and yeah, it was a very natural. I remember Kim's book being a very, very lovely, easy, easy thing to do. And, you know, it was a pleasure. So, and it did really well. So, yeah, it was nice. And the other thing about Kim is, you know, she was very honest in her book about lots of stuff that was kind of, you know, problematic. But she was never bitchy and never, you know, she's not a bitchy, horrible, you know, nasty person. So she was able to be honest about certain things without being mean.
Right, right. And it was a great read too. I do love the Kimberly book very, very much. And I guess we know when we've talked before, This Is Disco with Eliza and Danny, about your process co-writing Danny Is My Story. So it's interesting to see that it was, would you say, a similar process with Kimber, in that it was just very easy and...
I think with Dan's was probably more... I was with Dan's, I stayed in Australia for, right, you know, a month. working with her, and because we were old friends, it was just, you know, but it was, yeah, I suppose it was the most similar of all the books I've done to Danny's, because I already knew Kim, we'd already worked together,
right?
So there wasn't that thing of getting to know somebody much. There was already when you start to write someone's book, there's a huge trust thing. Obviously, they've got to trust you. So with Kim, it was very natural. We already knew one another, and also I knew that's the other thing when you're doing a music book. You know, having been in the music business, I already know a lot of the people they're talking about. So it cuts down on the, like if she talks about certain people in the record label and stuff like that, I don't have to then go and research who they are or get her to explain who they are or what they do, or that, because I already know. Yeah. And I know, you know, I know how the charts work. I know how the releases work. So with Kim, it was all, and you know, of course, Peter Lorraine was always a brilliant thing, because I say, because people can never remember dates. You know, they can never remember dates and this and that. You know, so Peter's brilliant because he is always kind of so on it with dates and when something came out and who did that video and what. So he was brilliant, a brilliant source to have.
Oh, that's
but
perfect.
Yeah, it was very, very easy. Yeah, I'm just about to start work with another pop star who I can't announce because they haven't announced that they're doing a book yet. But again, Peter was involved somewhere along the line for that. And again, he's going to be a wealth of help for me during that.
I'm excited to know more when it's when we can know more. Obviously, it is going to be a very a different process when it is somebody that you know well and is a part of your life.
Absolutely.
Do you have any, are there any memories of writing the book with Kimberly that you can share, of course, that make you crack up with laughter or, you know, that you're particularly fond of?
Do you know what? I don't know. I can't remember any specific, I mean, it's such a long, it's like 11 years ago now, but all I remember is just, you know, being at her house, sitting in her kitchen or sitting in the garden or in the living room in the sunshine, just it being really, really nice experience. That's all, you know, that's all. And also us just spending like probably too much time gossiping about musicals when we were supposed to be getting on with the book. That's mainly what I remember. The thing is, there was never any drama with Kimberly. So it was just, you know, she's very organized, professional person. And that makes her sound like, I'm not saying that she's not, you know, she's not boring or anything like that. She's just one of those people that you know, as someone to work with. I'm working with someone else at the moment, actually, who's very, very organized. And it really helps.
Right.
It really helps as a writer when someone's organized, their time's organized. And, you know, so that was a nice thing.
You also helped our beautiful Sarah co-write her incredible autobiography, Hear Me Out. And
yes.
How did Sarah first approached you to help her with that book?
Again, it was Lorraine, because Sarah, I found out Sarah was ill. That was the first thing. And I knew it wasn't good. We all kind of knew it was that quite bad from the start. So that was one thing where everyone was keeping under their, you know, belt for a long time. And then Peter had asked me, I think Peter and Hillary spoke to me about would I be up for doing it, because she wanted to do something. She didn't want to just sit at home. She wanted to work. But there wasn't a lot she could do because she was going through so much. It was, you know, back end of it was COVID still.
Yeah.
And so Peter thought, would a book be a good idea? So that's how it came about. But obviously the mechanics of that were never going to be easy. We couldn't see one another because it was during COVID. She was ill and having treatment, and you know, she was kind of all over the place mentally, not, you know, because there was so much going on. But you know, but I said, well, let's give it a go. And it, that without a doubt was the hardest book I've done ever. And I don't, you know, it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. For a start, when you're going through treatment, I would see Sarah and it didn't even look like Sarah. She didn't look like her. I would do Zooms like this, or not Zooms, or FaceTime or whatever, but it didn't even look like her. So, you know, because she was going through so much. So that was hard. She, bless Sarah's heart, what I loved about her is there was a lot of the time, especially at the start of it, where she'd be kind of all right. She was staying at her mum's. She always had like a massive glass of wine in her hand, you know, and we would, you know, so I'd get the best stories and I'm like, yeah, I can't put that in the book. No, I can't put that in the book. So it was like literally. But, you know, she was, and obviously she just let go and we just put, you know, we wrote everything. She was very, very honest, very candid, just went for it. We had a laugh. We, a lot of the time we worked in the evenings because she was sort of feeling better by then. Right. So, and I just kind of got on with it and wrote it. I talked to a lot of other people as well because there was certain stuff she couldn't do. So I did end up speaking to Nadine and Cheryl for the book. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did actually end up speaking to Nadine, to Kim and Nicola when we were going to do the update. We were going to update the paperback, but because Sarah passed away, we ended up not releasing the updated paperback. Right. We just left it at the yeah. So, but I did speak with Cheryl and Kim and Nadine for the book, and with Peter and with Hillary and a lot, and with Beth. I spoke with Beth, mm-hmm. and I did a lot of stuff that way as well, because obviously Sarah, you know, when you're having chemotherapy, you've got chemo brain. So they were great for telling stories that I could then go back to Sarah and say, oh, you know, Beth told me about this, and then that would flick Sarah into, oh yeah, and I remember this. So that's how I did a lot of the, obviously it was all told in Sarah's voice. Yeah. And I think, you know, when you read that, it very much is in Sarah's voice because, you know, she was just in my ear the whole time. Yeah. You know, it was me kind of, you know, speaking how she speaks, basically just my fingers translating her voice onto the page. But it was hard. There were times when I would come off the meeting and I would like burst into tears because it was, even now thinking about it makes me really upset. You know, it was really, really hard because I think I, having been through cancer myself, I kind of knew there was not a good, and also I lost my sister in 2018, which would have been a couple of years before that. And I've been through enough people with cancer to know that it was not going to be a good outcome. I knew that it wasn't a good, there wasn't going to be a good outcome. And that's why it was so hard, because, you know, she was full of hope, which you have to be. Yeah. And I, you know, and that was great. It was infectious, that hope, because I think, yeah, you know, this could happen, that could happen. But I think because it was so far down the line, we kind of knew. So yeah, there were times when I found it really, really hard, really hard.
It's got to be exceptionally different to any other book then, given those circumstances that you worked on.
Yeah, it's not something I would like to do every day. You know, it was, there's books when you've got people that are that have gone through massive difficulties, which is one thing, but when someone's face, when you've got to speak to someone, you know, that is facing death, you know, essentially, and you're going back over their life and the great times, that's a head fuck.
Yeah.
It really is, you know, for both of us, for her, because, you know, I don't know, I'm thinking to myself, how would I be sitting there talking about these fantastic times when you're on cloud nine and then suddenly it hitting you that you're facing death. I mean, I found that very difficult because, you know, you'd be laughing one minute and crying the next, and it was really tough. It was tough.
I would assume that people have come to you to work on stuff for them because of the strength of this book.
Oh my God, absolutely. You know, I mean, I've quite a few people have, when I go to interviews to do books, it's usually the first one they mention. So I think you're right. I think that it was a real gift to me to be able to do that book, because it did do really well. And it showed, I suppose, that I was able to tackle something difficult. So yeah, I've been working on a book at the moment, which is a big thing that's recently happened in the last couple of years. It's a big topic. It's with a woman that's been in the news and the public eye, and it's a difficult subject. There's a lot of difficult subject matter in there, and that's the book I'm just working on at the moment. Again, I can't really say who it is because I don't think it's been announced. Mm-hmm. But I think that Sarah's book would have gone a long way to helping me, for instance, get that book.
Right.
This book is probably going to be the biggest one I've ever done.
Wow! Really?
Mm. Oh, yeah, God. I think I think so. I don't know, yeah. But it's pretty big.
Well, that's exciting news. I'm looking forward to knowing more about that when we can.
Yeah, and I've got another one lined up after that, which is the other pop book. So it's good. It's been a good year, and I worked with Alfie Beau, the singer. I don't know how well known he is out there, but he's a very famous opera singer.
Yeah.
I worked with him this year, and again, I think I got his book because of Sarah's, because he has gone through hugely difficult, troubled times, and he's divorced, and he was in rehab, and I think that all came out of having done Sarah's book, because I didn't know Alfie, I didn't have a connection to him.
Right.
But his book's coming out next month, I think.
Oh, that's exciting. Oh, wow. Excellent.
Mm. So I've been busy.
You have
been busy.
Very, very busy. Well,
I have.
Let me ask you to lighten the mood a little bit. What is your favourite Girls Aloud album?
My favourite Girls Aloud album is Out of Control.
Mm-hmm. Great, great album.
Even though that's not the one with my favourite song on, I just think it's great. I think also having worked on that tour, it was, there's a lot of great songs on that. Loving Kind and, such great songs on that. Untouchable.
Oh.
Revolution in My Head. I love, and obviously it's got The Promise on. Yeah, I really love that album. Really love
beautiful,
it.
Beautiful, beautiful record.
And one thing I didn't talk about was the differences with the girls' voices, that they've all got something. I think that's the other thing I loved about working with them, that they've all got something, to offer vocally.
Right.
Obviously Nadine is the obvious, fuck off diva. She was like the person who's like, you need like a job doing, Nadine's your girl. She's brilliant. She just goes for it. Then you had Sarah, who had that amazing, rockiness to her voice, soulful, like heart rockiness. And, when she did something, it was so obviously Sarah. It's almost like she didn't belong in a group. She belonged because her voice was so distinct.
Right.
Kimberly, had that lovely, quite warm, low, husky sound. She was very sexy sounding, and she could do that kind of quite musical, very melodic. Cheryl was just absolute pure pop. And interestingly, when we did the tour, she wasn't always the one that did all the showy off vocals, but I remember coming off that tour feeling so like that Cheryl had like been the most consistent, like bang on singer, that I was just so reliable and had just delivered every time. She knew what she did and she just did it really well. And that's what I loved about Cheryl's was. And Nicola has this, when she does a little bit in a song, you just kind of melt.
Yeah.
Like her bit in Call the Shots.
Oh.
And her bit, her verse in Whole Lot of History. I mean, her voice is just that sweet, brittle, just gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. And, she sort of was one of the ones that I felt was kind of in the background vocally. And then, the more it went on, You know, every time Nicola got a bit, you kind of looked forward to that bit because it was so sweet. And that's what I loved about the girls. They all had something, you know. I loved it when Kimberly always did her sort of breathy sort of bits, you know, at the beginning of songs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just all had great things about their voices. I think that's what made them so, so identifiable, you know, as, yeah, Nadine always got the kind of, she got loads of the leads and stuff. Wow. But that's what made all the other little bits so exciting when you heard the other girls coming in and doing their bit. Because they all sounded so great.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Call the Shots as well, because everybody brings up that sweet, sweet moment from Nicola in Call the Shot, which is such an important part of the song as well. And it just, melts my heart.
Nicola had some fantastic bits in the later songs. Is it the Loving Kind? I'm trying to remember. But there's, I think Untouchable as well. She's got a really sweet, mm-hmm. bit in. I mean, it's just she just had such great bits in her songs. Her voice is lovely, really lovely. You know, there was a point when they nearly got dropped because no one knew what was going to happen after Life Got Cold. It was all a bit, no one really knew what was going on, right. And it was they weren't being managed particularly well. They didn't really know what direction they were going in, you know, and everyone goes on about Life Got Cold, like, you know, not being, it was still quite a relatively big hit, wasn't it? Early in the UK. I think it was Jump that saved them, really.
Right.
It was Jump that sort of doing that was what sort of brought them back into the limelight, really.
Right. Also,
they're not into the limelight, because they weren't out of the limelight, but, you know, but kicked it off big time.
Right. It was also their most successful chart success here in Australia as well with Jump.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, crazy, crazy. Well, I'm going to wrap it up, so I'm not taking up too much more of your time, but I did want to ask you, you are working on quite a lot at the moment, and
yes.
There's lots of stuff happening, so what can you share with us, well, with myself and the listeners, about upcoming projects and where people can find you, that kind of thing?
You can find me on, you know, I'm on sort of Twitter, but I find it a bit evil, so...
Same.
I've gone on Threads now. Same, yes. Mainly Instagram is my thing. You know, I'm just a Terry Ronald on Instagram. It's lots of pictures of cats and, but you know, I do keep up with all my work stuff on there, Instagram and Twitter really. And with what I'm doing, you know, I'm always doing my books. I'm doing, as I say, I'm actually got three books that I'm working on at the moment, various stages, all very different Alfie books coming out. My main thing is obviously working towards Becoming Nancy, which is the musical of my novel, mm-hmm. which will starting in Birmingham Rep, and it's quite a big thing next year in September. It's the guy that directed Hairspray and Pretty Woman and Legally wow. Blonde, you know, Jerry Mitchell is directing it. It's fantastic. And what I would always say to anyone, you know, especially if anyone's enjoyed my books that I've written for the girls, is to go and read my novel, which is called Becoming Nancy, mm-hmm. which you can get on Amazon, because that is the one that's been turned into a musical. It's a coming of age gay love story set in the late 70s and is full of pop music from the era.
Right.
And I think there's obviously a lot of, I think, Girls Aloud fans that probably dance down our end of the ballroom. So, so they would be very interested in it.
Right.
You know, geeky boy falls in love with sexy jock footballer and has lots of fun. And way before Heartstopper. So yeah, I think that's what I'd always love people to go and discover, you know, of me is my book, because it's kind of the proudest thing I've ever done. And the musical, very excited about the musical finally coming to the UK, because it's been in America.
Yes, yes. So when is the musical launching in the UK officially?
It is launching in September of 2024. I mean, it's ages off, but it takes a long time. It was in America, COVID hit, decided to do it here. It's got to be recast. It's got to be rehearsed. We had to get a really prestigious theatre. We couldn't just throw it anywhere. It had to be one in the big sort of out of town theatres. And Birmingham Rep was one of the ones we wanted to go for. And that was the first kind of slot we could get. So it's part of their 2024 season, which is very, very exciting. The best thing about it now is that, you know, my friend Steve Anderson is now the musical supervisor on the show. Mm-hmm. So anyone that loves what I do and what Steve does and loves a bit of gay romance, that's the show for you. Because obviously, knowing what you know about Steve Anderson, the show is going to sound amazing.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's very exciting.
No, that is incredible. Incredible, incredible stuff. Well, I wish you all the best of luck with the three new books and the stage show. It's absolutely exciting. And I will no doubt, hopefully, get to come over and see it next year, fingers crossed. But Terry, I want to thank you so, so much for taking time out of your schedule to chat with me on the Girls Aloud podcast. This has been a long time coming, and it really just means so, so, so much. So thank you again.
Oh, thank you, Ben. Thanks.
Thank you so, so much again to the incredible Terry Ronald for a super, super insightful chat about the girls and his work with the girls. It seriously was beyond my absolute pleasure, and I hope you all enjoyed it just as much as I did. I will be back very, very soon. Keep an eye on the socials for more information. But until then, this is Adam Eve signing off on yet another episode of the Girls Aloud podcast. You can follow me at Aloud Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram and Threads, I guess. You can also follow me at Adam Disco, that's AdemDisco on both Twitter, Instagram, or rather on all Twitter, Instagram and Threads. It doesn't quite make sense. And you can also follow The Record Doctor at The Record Doctor on Twitter, Instagram, Threads. Oh my God, there's also This Is Disco, my Danny and Kylie Minogue podcast with the wonderful Eliza Day, which you can also catch on podcasting, or if you're listening to this, basically. And my new podcast, or rather my new-ish podcast, The Record Library, which has just had two relatively new episodes where I interview Eurovision 2023 finalists, Serbia's Luke Black and Slovenia's Joker Out. Plenty to keep you busy until the next episode. Until then, I will speak to you guys online. Bye.
This is You Can't Mistake Their Anthology, a Girls Aloud commentary podcast from The Record Doctor.